So, hello, thank you all for being here. I'd like to thank the foundation members for their trust that they've placed in me, and especially Prince Abbas, Francis Gotto, Sufa Rashidi, and Anoush Tashemi, and Eugene Rogan, of course. I was very excited to begin working on the Abbas Henry II collection, and I'm very, very excited to develop the project further. I had heard about it briefly because a couple of scholars have in fact worked on it, and it was something that a few years ago I was thinking, oh, it would be so wonderful to have a chance to work on this, but you know, when will I ever get to Durham? And now here I am. So it's serendipitous for me. So of course many of you are already familiar with this archive, and some of you perhaps even more than I am. But one of its particularities is that various individuals have studied it or parts of it in great detail and know it quite intimately. But until now, perhaps there hasn't been sufficient opportunity for them to share their knowledge with a broader public of lay people and scholars. So today, for those who are not yet acquainted with it or with all of it, I mean, I'm not acquainted with all of it either, but I've spent a few weeks looking at as much of it as I possibly could. So I will sketch out in very broad outlines what it contains, and I've proposed a chapter structure for the book that we are going to be producing. And I'll try and look a little bit at the implications of what it can offer historians, since that's what I am. And in the second part of the presentation, I'll outline some of the concrete ways in which I think that this book will serve the collection and ensure that it receives the recognition that it deserves, which fulfills one of the missions of the fellowship. The Abbas Henry II papers consist principally of the official and personal correspondence and papers of the last Khedive of Egypt. And they cover the period, first of all, from 1892 to 1914 when he ruled, and then the time that he spent in exile after he was deposed until he passed away in 1944. The collection covers a wide and at times very eclectic range of topics. Some of the topics are political, social, and economic affairs in Egypt, the British occupation, some aspects of it, Egypt's relations with the region, the Khedive's relations with members of the ruling family and the British administrators, and there are many other topics as well, and I'll again go into some detail in a little while. So the papers also show Abbas Henry's interest in and involvement with the Egyptian nationalist movement, and there are other files that contain letters from family, friends, diplomats, clerics, and others. What I would like is to see this collection come alive through research that honours its unique nature while making it accessible to non-specialists, because it's not a collection, it's not exactly a state archive, it's not exactly a private archive. It's a little bit of both and somewhere in between. And so although its particularities, I think, must be honoured, and I think that we can do that with the book that we're producing, I think that we'll be able to convey quite complex information to a broad audience, even an audience of non-specialists, and produce a work that is, that's the ambition at least, both erudite and compelling. So this is particularly important because there's a crisis currently besetting state archives in Egypt and almost every other Arabic-speaking country, and that's part of my effort to contextualize the archive. In many parts of the region, war or armed conflict of different sorts has destroyed central archives, state archives, or made them inaccessible. And so scholars in much of the region face acute concrete problems in gaining actual physical access to archives. So for historians working, for example, on Syria or Iraq or Libya or Yemen, they have obviously insurmountable difficulties in recovering historical documents. And what artifacts do survive armed conflict often pass into private markets, and that creates another set of barricades against scholars because it's not always possible to see what is in private collections, let alone the wider public. And even for historians in countries that are not being torn apart by war, research is fraught with real immediate risks beyond harassment, intimidation, stonewalling that we're all familiar with, and that has come to be the price that we pay for access to information. Now I'll try and speak a little bit about the archive in this context, and because Egypt is the site where I carried out most of my primary source research, as a historian, I'll try and give you a sense of the situation now. For those who wish to access the archives, this will give kind of a backdrop against which we can understand the importance of the Abbas Henry collection more clearly. So at the National Archives in Egypt, where the bulk of the administrative and legal records dating from the Ottoman period are kept, it's becoming increasingly difficult for researchers to obtain a permit. When I began archival work in 1994, before some of you were born. The archives were kept at the Property Registration Bureau. These are the Ottoman State Archives, Legal Archives, etc. And one would just walk in and pull a register off the shelf, how innocent we were, and sit down. You know, the historians were sitting around drinking tea and chit-chatting, and there were mice and sometimes cockroaches scuttling about. But then they were moved to the National Archives, obviously in far better conditions. There was no impromptu restoration work, which I witnessed, someone gluing together registers and sort of signing his name on them, saying that he had finished restoring them. It was sweet in its own way. So now that doesn't happen anymore. But since 2011, and in particular since 2013, the archives have been under the growing control of state security services, and they've convened a committee of historians to vet and filter applications. So if a historian wants to gain access to your archive, you have to write a research proposal, fair enough. You also have to say which archival collections you're going to be looking at, which is difficult because they're not online. So you have to know what you're working on before you start working on it. And once you've said which archival collections you're going to work on, if indeed you do get permission, you can never see anything else. So you have to cast a kind of very wide net. No one knows who the historians are who are serving on the committee. No one knows which standards they apply in choosing which applications to approve and which to reject. There are very broad and vague criteria, somehow relating to national security, but I've heard that they have a list of words, and if those keywords appear in an application, they reject it summarily. So those words include things like land, social class, nation, resistance, very, very broad and very vague, but no one is quite sure. It induces paranoia. It's also quite fun. And that doesn't really explain why historians who work, for example, on land tenure in the 18th century, a colleague of mine not only had his application rejected, but was then barred for life from the archives. Doesn't seem clear how 18th century land tenure could threaten the government, or 19th century educational reforms. A former student of mine was just also rejected in the archives. So the process is quite absurd, but the end result is that it's become almost impossible now to gain access to the National Archives. And in any case, for decades now, there have been various archival series that were just off-limits to historians for various reasons, either because they were under restoration for decades or because they were just not available or they were considered sensitive material. There are other state-controlled archives in Egypt, and they're, apart from the National Archives, they're equally difficult to study. So the contents of the archives of the financial administration, which are preserved in a building known as Dar al-Mahfuzat, they're not public knowledge. There's no, and actually one of the members of the advisory panel, I suppose, Adam Messian, who's not here with us today, he has worked there, and he compiled a quite useful list of sort of pieces of advice for people who want to go there. So he says Dar al-Mahfuzat retains archival functions, but it's not an archive per se. It's a functioning governmental office with the responsibility of safeguarding highly sensitive information related to state and private income. Not surprisingly, security is tight. And he concludes it is also possible that the revolutionary atmosphere in 2011 made state institutions more defensive. So basically, one could go there for 3 hours a day if, again, one was able to obtain the permit, which took around a year. It was a very long and difficult process. And the same goes for the Ministry of Endowments, where very important endowment deeds are kept from the Awqaf, the Ministry of Awqaf, but where one also has to be interviewed by state security and vetted for things like one's appearance, one's accent, one's way of speaking Arabic, etc. I have many personal anecdotes that I will leave you to imagine about how my interview went. So there's a current atmosphere of what we could call, I think without exaggeration, xenophobia, and now it's expanded the definition of foreignness or, you know, a potential sort of enemy of the regime to include anyone who could be identified as somehow suspicious. And this is what Khalid Fahmi, another of the people who are not here today from the foundation, has he's identified this as a security mindset, and he says it started pervading the Egyptian academic and scientific landscape in the aftermath of 2011. This has become more intense since 2013, when the coup that installed the current regime took place. And in 2016-2017, the Egyptian government granted sovereignty to Saudi Arabia over two islands in the Red Sea. This caused a popular sort of, a lot of popular dissatisfaction, let's say, and people produced maps, historical maps, to show that Egypt had in fact exercised sovereignty over those islands. And ever since then, maps have also become, it's like the government all of a sudden realized that maps can be dangerous. And so this has increased, let's say, the level of suspicion and the level of wariness on the part of the security forces. So in other words, just to summarize, not to go on about this for too long, various archives have different levels of gatekeepers, and they range from state security to the people in the reading room who say, you can see this, but you can't see that, defined according to the national interest. Apart from these issues, which are related to the transformation of the Egyptian state and the extension of its prerogatives, because obviously, I mean, archival research is political, whether we like it or not. I'm fond of the 19th century because everyone's dead, but one still remains, you know, very sort of bound to contemporary problems. And so as I hinted at before, those who conduct research in and on modern Egyptian history also have to contend with the forces of privatization and the channeling of historical records into these circuits of commercial exchange. One historian, she's worked on the 1920s and 30s, and now she collects photographs of early 20th century Egypt, so she knows the market quite well. Her name is Lucy Rizova, and she says in an article, historical photographs are an important part of Cairo's vibrant private market for vintage objects, one fully integrated into the global market. Here they are considered unique and valued commodities widely sought after by both local and international collectors. It's true that the whole sort of mood of nostalgia that's pervaded Egypt in particular for the past, I would say maybe decade, has made these photographs and any other kind, and anything you can frame basically and put in your house to show that you have historical legitimacy, these have acquired a lot of symbolic and material value. So we have specific obstacles when searching for archival evidence, and this is precisely the moment when archival evidence has become sort of the main criterion of scholarly legitimacy. It's very difficult to produce a work on Egypt today that doesn't use the Ottoman archives if one's working on Ottoman history, just based on secondary sources, for example, to such an extent that, you know, now people say, oh, you're an archival fetishist. And that's not always a good thing. So this overview hopefully has provided a context for the importance of the Abbas Henry collection, which really has a crucial place in the larger archival picture. And this would be so even if it only because it's so accessible relative to the other collections that we have. So, of course, it's much more than that. It's not just accessible. It's also quite a unique archive. And, of course, there are other archives as well. For example, the records produced by the colonial administration of British-occupied Egypt, which are at the British National Archives. And these comprise many important documents that historians are only now beginning to discover, such as, for example, reports on Egyptian peasants who were conscripted into the labor corps and sent off to aid in the war effort. And here at Durham as well, there is the Sudan archive, which is also very important, I think, for putting the Abbas Henry collection in context. And historians who work on the Abbas Henry archive will need to make connections between them to situate their specific topic within a broader picture. So, again, like any archive, this collection is subject to the specific logic that presided over its constitution, and as in the case of any archive, we also need to take into account the conditions of its production if we want to avoid a very naive and positivistic approach that assumes that we're coming face to face with some, you know, limpid and unvarnished version of what really happened in a specific time and place. But this is, however, maybe one of the greatest opportunities that the collection offers. Not only can we study its contents, which are remarkable, and not only can we study the very specific combination of public and private interests that they represent, we can also understand the conditions in which they were created and preserved by speaking to one of the individuals who were instrumental in that process, and that's really an exceptional opportunity. So we have an online catalogue. It's very, very good and very detailed. It does need improvement. But it's as an introduction and kind of a broad overview of the things that are in the different sections, it's extremely useful. So it tells us that Abbas Henry II, the great-great-grandson of Muhammad Ali, was born on the 14th of July 1874 and succeeded his father, Muhammad Tawfiq Pasha, as Khedive in 1892. And it talks about the period that the papers cover until his death on the 21st of December 1944 at Geneva. The catalogue is organised into six broad categories. So the first is official, political and diplomatic. The second is estates, business interests, finances, and property. The third is personal. The fourth is photographs. So there's one photograph here, and I will show some more in a little while, because the photographs are really remarkable. There are photograph albums that are so beautiful, and the pictures are so, as to my knowledge at least, so unique that I think that any, and you know, it would be a dream if all of the photograph albums could actually be made into books in their own right. Then there are objects, and finally there are letters. So the categories are useful, and each category contains a detailed description of the kinds of documents that are contained in the relevant section. But when I came to draft a chapter outline, I didn't follow the categorization. I tried to set up more specific kinds of chapters, and ones that require that those who are going to receive this fellowship cut across the categories that are already pre-established in the archive to carry out their research. So I'll talk a little bit about, that's sort of the rest of what I'll be talking about today, the chapter outline that I've drafted, and hopefully this will also give you an overview of what's in the archive and some of the ways in which it can be used. So I thought that it would be very interesting to start with an introduction about making the archive. And if Prince Abbas agrees to this, this would be an overview of the archive's history, situating the archive in its historical setting, and taking advantage of Prince Abbas's central role and his extraordinary memory, as well as his gift for enthralling storytelling, to convey the living context in which the collection was constituted. So it would hopefully, and maybe we can persuade him, include an oral history of the archive's formation. And this would allow us to examine two fundamental questions which are interrelated. The first is, what does the archive, as it was initially constituted, tell us about Abbas Helmi II, about the overlap between a personal or a family archive and a state archive, about the period of the occupation, the monarchy, Egyptian society, the ruling class? And the second fundamental question to my mind, what does the process of the archive's preservation show us? So in a sense, the afterlife of the dynasty, the place of the royal family in Egypt after 1952, and the ways also in which it continues to shape some aspects of public life. So again, in theory, that would be the introduction. Perhaps we'll have to do a lot of convincing. In the first chapter, because the archive talks quite a lot about regional matters, Egypt in its regional context, what I'm suggesting is to have, as a first chapter, crises, wars, and uprising through the archive. So, for example, some parts of the archive mention the Arabi uprising of 1882, but they don't provide exhaustive coverage of this event, because it sort of predates the beginning of Abbas Helmi's period in power. Others are devoted to the question of Sudan and its administration. There's one folder or file titled Yusuf Zakakinibi, which contains correspondence concerning the political situation in Istanbul and the Assyrian uprising. So I'm just giving examples of the different kinds of crises or upheavals that beset the region. The 1908 coup in Istanbul, echoes of World War I. So obviously all of these crises are not related to each other directly, but they all had an impact on the Egyptian ruling class, and so this is an interesting lens through which to see them. In a second chapter, again looking at the region, but focusing more on the central Ottoman lands, the Hejaz and the Fertile Crescent, so Western Arabia and the Fertile Crescent, there's quite a lot in the archive, including pictures, on the pilgrimage. So there are many pictures of the Mahmal, which was sent from Egypt, arriving in Mecca. It was a big procession, not only a diplomatic, but also sort of an event for a popular celebration. There are papers about pilgrims and others in the Hejaz, so in the holy cities in that region. There are also papers related to Hassan Khalid Pasha Abul Huda Sayyadi. So he was the son of a religious advisor who exercised considerable authority in Istanbul. But Hassan Khalid Pasha himself was the chief advisor to the Transjordan government. So it would be interesting to look at how networks of influence in the region were constituted. And there are references as well to relations between the Khedive and the rulers of the Hejaz in the 1930s, for example. So just as one example, a letter from the Khedive to the British High Commissioner in Transjordan objecting to a loan that he had given to the rulers of the Hejaz. The third chapter, again, that I'm proposing, would cover regional relations with a focus on Sudan. So again, perhaps it would be possible for a researcher working on this to work on the Sudan archive as well. Because this, in this archive at least, in the Ashani collection, we really get a unique view of the ways that the Egyptian ruling class related to the British occupation authorities over the question of how to manage the condominium and which resources to devote to its management. So there are sections on public works, the budget, communications, and transport, but there are also very richly textured anecdotes, which to me, because I'm not a not really a political or a diplomatic historian, I'm always interested in the little anecdotes that give history life, in my opinion. So there's a story about, and it's told by an informant who overheard the conversation, I think, a man who went to visit his son. He had got him enrolled in the Sudan campaign, and he went to give him advice and exhort him to be brave in battle, and he cited the example of Khalid ibn al-Walid, one of the, you know, the generals who led the early Islamic conquests. And the son listened to him obediently, and then he replied, "But we are going to Sudan, and they are like us, الَّذِينَ هُمَّ مِنَّا. And we're doing so for the interests of the occupiers, and not for the purposes and benefits of our lands, or to preserve our wealth and souls." And then he tells his father, and this is the really striking part, "Your advice will result in the death of a kafir, an unbeliever, because I'm going to fight Muslims of my race and my country. And I believe that those of them who die are martyrs because they are protecting their nation," and he uses the word watan, "and their honor and supporting their religion. Whereas we will die as apostates because we are attacking them so as to deliver them to the English and put them in their hands as we are, and so that rules and laws others than the Sharia apply to them." Mm-hmm. So where else can you read something like that? Mm-hmm. When I read that, I was just sort of half laughing and half crying, mm-hmm. hyperventilating. And that's, you know... Anyway, very exciting. The fourth chapter that I'm proposing is a view of the dynasty, the Muhammad Ali dynasty, in the time of the British occupation. And I think that it would be very interesting if this chapter focused on Abbas Henry II himself. He seems to have been an extremely popular ruler, perhaps because he was a supporter of the nationalist movement and he resisted British rule. And this was at a time when mass politics was developing in ways that perhaps have been insufficiently documented. So even around 1905 or 1906, one sees hints of what is much more richly documented for 1919. And actually, Saif told me about two fascinating things that I will mention here. One is contained in the archive, and it's a narrative of the Khedive's travels through Europe, where he stopped in very small villages and was welcomed with great exuberance by the local population. And then there's an anecdote, but I don't know if this is recounted in the archive or if it was Prince Abbas who told it, about him going to, when he was in Geneva, meeting two students and knowing not only where they came from, but the name of the umda of their village. So to show how intimately acquainted he was with the tiniest details of his country. The other very interesting thing is not in the collection, and I will scroll through quickly and then I'll go back to the rest of the pictures. So it's a collection of amulets also brought to my attention by Saif, who knows such a lot about so many things. Oops, here we go. These are, there are ceremonies in Egypt that you're probably all familiar with called Zohr, not only in Egypt, but they are sort of exorcism ceremonies. And they require, among other things, that the people being whose demons are being exorcised or placated wear certain items of dress. And among these items are amulets. So this amulet in particular is engraved with the likeness of the Khedive, and in fact it says Abbas Helfi on it, and it seems to have been used in an exorcism ceremony. So again, this sort of supports, it's quite extraordinary, it supports this idea that the Khedive was a figure who was perhaps regarded almost as a Mahdi, or as someone, because he had been exiled by the British, someone who would return and deliver Egypt from the occupiers. Saif, again, also told me about a chant or a slogan that was chanted, which said, "Allah hay, Abbas gay," God is alive and Abbas is coming. So, you know, it's this sort of messianic, almost, popular belief. It's again very interesting, and perhaps I don't know if we have. I mean, today obviously there's. No, I'm not going to go there. So anyway, there's much of interest, let's just say, regarding the Khedive and his relatives and the dynamics of relations within the dynasty. But these are really, you know, some of the more, I think, exceptional aspects that we can look at. The fifth chapter that I'm proposing is about property. And there are many documents in the archive about the Daila Khassa, so the Khedive's estates. But there are also, there's also a lot of information on other other types of property. So there's there are files relating to his assets and business investments and the attempts that he made after he was deposed to recover his sequestered property. These documents offer a glimpse into what the ruling family owned and the ways in which it's... I don't think that this is specific to Abbas Helmi. I think that during this period, what we consider today to be private property, state property, and public property were not yet delineated, let's say, in the way that they are today. So it's interesting to have a snapshot at this point in time of an understanding of property, let's say, that is quite different from our own. A time in which the private wealth of the ruler and public wealth or assets of state, even if they didn't overlap, there was discussion about which was which. So it's also during this period, this is sort of an interest of mine separate from the archive, it's during this period that the state undergoes a transformation that makes it into the only possible guardian of the public interest, or at least so it says about itself. But this process was entangled with efforts to define just what that interest was, like what is the public interest and who gets to name it, really. And many of the documents in the collection were produced in the course of conflicts between different stakeholders over assets like land or pious endowments. So there are conflicts over Awqaf. And the ways that these conflicts played out ultimately determined legal developments and social relations as well until 1952 at least, and perhaps beyond. So, of course, there's a documentation of Abbas Helmi's efforts to recover his property after he was deposed, and the kinds of legal disputes that took place with the British over what was his and what was the property of the state. And the process of the archive's constitution also gives insight into this discussion because it contains documents, and this is something that Adam Essien was pointing out, documents that we would regard as private and documents that we would regard as state business, but in fact it's not, that clear distinction, in my opinion, did not exist in the same way at the time. And it would also be possible, depending on the number of scholars who apply for the fellowship successfully, to have a completely separate chapter on the Awqaf, depending also on what we agree on. A sixth chapter, and I haven't gone into this in detail, should, I think, discuss ruling class women, because their charitable activities, their involvement in politics, all of these come through the archive. There are numerous photographs. Their organizing public health campaigns, their educational activism, and again, I think that this would be very useful. Two chapters remain in my proposed outline. One I've titled A New Urban Geography, because the archive offers us a very valuable insight into the way this development of mass politics used the city of Cairo and to some extent also Alexandria. I think also the photographs of the processions in various towns that followed the Khedive here, for example, and here, the ways in which railroads transformed urban space, the ways in which politics used the new architecture of the city in a place like Cairo, for example. There are informers' reports about demonstrations gathering in Esbakeya Gardens, and the way the informers find out how many demonstrators there are is by going to the people at the gate and saying how many people bought tickets today. So 2,500, yeah, it's quite, I mean, given the rudimentary means at their disposal, it's pretty sophisticated. 2,500, and they estimate that out of those 2,500, perhaps 2,000 or 2,200 were demonstrators. Then they march from Esbakeya, and the report traces the path that they follow until they get to Kostolayni. And so you really see that they're going through what we would call Ismailiyya, so, you know, sort of the Europeanized part of the city, to manifest their opposition to British rule. So these wide-open boulevards, which have been designed in the 19th century, are being used to express public opposition to state policies, to protest the occupation or to do things like demand educational reform. Oh, I lied. There is another chapter after. But I'll be done soon. So chapter 8, I think, is related to chapter 7, because if chapter 7 is about resistance, chapter 8 should go into that resistance, I think, in more detail. I've titled it Under Surveillance, because it's quite difficult to separate out the creation of an apparatus for monitoring political activity and that political activity itself. So perhaps that this could also be two chapters. There was a lot of irrepressible political activity during this period. And it seems that different parts of the ruling class did perceive it as necessary somehow, because this is one of the things that gave the Khedive, for example, legitimacy. But at the same time, it had to be harnessed, or it had to be at least managed and contained so that it wouldn't lead to the overthrow of the state. But we really see through the documents the creation of students' associations, workers' associations, the Nationalist Party setting up night schools that people are attending in large numbers. So there's really a sort of political effervescence long before people have traced the roots of 1919. They say there's a lot of political activity in 1917, and it kind of culminates in 1919. But this is 10 or 15 years before. So clearly this is something that goes through from the end of the 19th century and sort of keeps on building and organizing itself. One of the most interesting dossiers in the archive, to my mind, contains the Dinh Shui petitions. So I don't know if you're familiar with the Dinh Shui incident, 1906. Very briefly, for those who aren't, there are some British officers go to the village of Dinh Shui. They're going to shoot pigeons. I don't know if they thought that pigeons were like grouse, but even grouse, I mean, were often private property. But anyway, they started shooting pigeons, which belonged to villagers. So the villagers came out to protest. The wife of the mayor was shot. They set fire to a haystack, I think. There was a big uproar, and several of the British officers died. One ran away and seems to have died of heat stroke. And the peasant who was helping him was accused of having killed him. Anyway, the peasants were rounded up and given extremely harsh punishments. This was in 1906, but it fueled the nationalist movement, and it galvanized public opinion. So this dossier contains petitions, some of which are typewritten or printed, and some of which are written by hand, which came from all over the country with people's seals or their signatures and their professions a lot of the time. There were also petitions that were sent by students of particular schools, and it would really be possible to kind of map out where all of this resistance was coming from, what socioeconomic category the signatories were from, etc. The petitions are really, really fascinating. As for policing and surveillance, there are some files that contain reports that I mentioned by informants who were assigned to monitor the dangerous classes, but also some members of the ruling family whose behavior was considered potentially problematic. Either they were, you know, engaging in disorderly conduct, or they had just been targeted for observation. And so you have an informer saying, you know, I saw so-and-so leaving his house at such and such a time, or so-and-so, and she was in the company of a Bedouin guard, etc. And again, you know, they can be just anecdotes, or they can point to a wider picture of an apparatus of state observation that's being developed, and that's also a very important part of state building at the time. The ninth, and this time almost final chapter, would be devoted to the ulama. And again, the ulama during the entire period that the archive covers are a group that undergoes quite profound transformations. There are themes that come through in the archive of, there are a lot of complaints about corruption and nepotism. There are signs of unrest. There are demands for reform, reform of Al-Azhar in particular, which actually did go through at one point. There are files on Muhammad Abdu, and there are files on Al-Azhar, which really show the Mosque University as a kind of melting pot where students from everywhere in the Islamic world came and honed their scholarship, their rhetorical abilities, but also their political activism. So scholars will find a lot of material that can serve to shift existing paradigms on the involvement of the ulama in political matters, because they were, you know, very clearly involved. Student activism, student opposition to their teachers, and the efforts to transform religious education. There are also documents, you know, hinting at intrigues and rivalries, and those can be entertaining. So, for example, there's one file on Muhammad Tawfiq al-Bakri, he's asking the Khedive for protection against a rival of his. He's promising to pay some money to someone that he owes money to. He's asking for assistance in obtaining his share of certain endowments. So there's a lot that is, again, quite textured and personal. And finally, in the same file, because it's not just El-Bakri's complaints, there's also anonymous correspondence with regard to his visits, El-Bakri's visits to Europe and Turkey, referring to corrupt activities in which he was allegedly involved. The final chapter, so the very, very final chapter, it would be pictures. And so would it be a chapter or would it be a book or several books? This is what we were mentioning earlier. You can see here, I'll go back to the very beginning to show you the pictures. These were just selected at random. And you can see the wide variety of topics that they cover. And the extraordinary detail of these photographs, many of whom were taken by very, very, you know, talented photographers. Here's a detail of the mahmal. Egyptian soldiers loading a muzzle-loading howitzer, possibly part of coastal defenses, under the supervision of senior army officers. A panoramic view showing Egyptian sailing craft docked at Jeddah. So one here, or and especially in the pictures of Mecca, I mean, you could not recognize Mecca, certainly, the way it is today. None of the architecture is, none of the traditional architecture is extant. The upper view of the courtyard and the Kaaba in the sanctuary in Mecca before the 20th century enlargements, and all of the, as the caption says, the vernacular architecture surrounding the enclosure and the kiosks are now non, these buildings are non-extant. It's a nice way of saying that they were demolished. Panoramic view of the pilgrimage tents in an encampment site, official members of the Egyptian pilgrimage delegation with the mahmal. Caravan, Egyptian train passing next to a service site, horses, many, many horses. This is a light-colored horse. I'm sure that there's a technical term for this light-colored horse that I don't know, because I don't know about horses. A gray. There we go. Thank you. Poseidon Ismailia. This is one of my favorites. A triumphal arch at Asyut to celebrate the arrival of the yacht of Khedive Tawfiq at the beginning of the railway road. The arch is topped by a crown and a profusion of Egyptian flags and a sign that reads, "Long live our Khedive Tawfiq of Egypt." Other signs and emblems with either the name of Tawfiq or Muhammad Tawfiq. Two of the sides are inscribed with Arabic poetry of welcome. Spectateur fait là près du yacht Khedivial. So, there. I don't know where it is exactly, doesn't say. Crowds greeting the Khedive's train at Manouf station with flags and bunting. I was talking about women of the dynasty, Zeynep Henim, 12th daughter of Muhammad Ali, so it's a portrait of her. Photographic copy of a painting. Prince Muhammad Abdul Halim. Okay. The interior of the Ilhemi School of Fine Arts shop, ceramics, furniture, metalware, animal products, and statues. The heightening of the first Aswan Dam. Yeah, exactly. I think the people in the library are tired of me going, the casket of Abbas II. And here's the Zahra amulet that I mentioned. Okay, that's it. So finally, just in conclusion, with regard to the format of the fellowship, I think that we can discuss the details. Of course, what is wonderful is that we have digital copies of parts of the archive in locations other than Durham, which means that quite a few people can work on it. And of course, although I've proposed a sort of thematic structure here, the final chapter outline is going to depend on the capabilities of the people who do apply for the scholarship and are successful in that. So, of course, you know, we should be flexible in defining the scope and specific topic of each chapter, but what is certain is that the fellowship recipients, and definitely myself among them, were privileged to be working on a really unique archive at a critical time, and hopefully we'll have an exceptional volume as the result of our collective labour. Thank you.
Thank you.